Okay, as you probably know, there's a midterm next Wednesday. A few comments on the midterm. I'm going to have a review session next Tuesday, June 3rd at 4:30. At 4:30? It'll be on the website. I'll put it on the website. And it's going to be in the room next door, AQ3003. For the review session, I'm not going to be giving any lecture. I'll just answer questions. So bring your best questions. I figure by the night before the midterm, you've probably started studying, and there may be a few questions that have come up. But, you know, I've been wrong before, so. But I'll be there to answer any questions. Okay, any questions on the midterm or life in general? What's the meaning of the midterm? Of life? It's easier to answer what's the meaning of the midterm. 20% of your grade, that's what it means. Life, I still don't have a clue. Any other questions? So the format is short answers. There'll be a few fill in the blanks. No multiple choice, multiple guests, whatever. Okay. All right, so we left, where are we? This is Wednesday. We're talking Monday about substrates for the heart. And we talked about how fats are the dominant substrate. And we talked about beta oxidation. We talked about glucose oxidation and glycolysis. And in terms of other substrates, and I don't mean to denigrate this as a substrate, we began talking about lactate. And I just want to finish up that discussion. So lactate appears in the blood. And the concentration of lactate in the blood varies, of course, as you probably already know, from a level of about 1 millimolar to levels that may be 10 or 20 millimolar, depending on the level of exercise that you're doing. Of course, skeletal muscle produces lactate when it's pushed beyond its normal aerobic capacity. That's something I'll talk about before if you haven't talked about it already. So the concentration varies, and the concentration will determine its usage by the heart to a certain degree. Lactate is like glucose, it's hydrophilic, lipophobic, and so in order to get from the blood into the cells, in this case we're talking about cardiac cells, there is a lactate transporter. And actually this transporter is a lactate hydrogen ion symport. Excuse me? A symport means that it brings both of these components in the same direction. So normally in the heart, it's bringing lactate and hydrogen ions. Into the cell. And then we talked before, briefly, about how lactate can be used. And lactate is converted to pyruvate. And the enzyme that catalyzes this is lactate dehydrogenase. Now, apparently someone corrected me. I put wrong terminology on the board. In the process of lactate going to pyruvate, we reduce the NAD. So let me just make sure that I've got it correct this time. NAD plus becomes reduced to NADH. And because NADH is reduced, it means for this reaction to continue, the NADH has to become oxidized. And the way that it becomes oxidized is like it does for every other metabolic pathway. It has to go into the electron transport system. Blah, 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 blah. And this requires oxygen.
Isn't that the other way around? Yeah. Isn't lactate being NAD+ and then you make NAD+ and then lactate?
This is the other way around. So in glycolysis in skeletal muscle, when you make lactate, you're oxidizing NAD to allow glycolysis to continue. That's the normal pathway for anaerobic metabolism. So you're oxidizing NADH, and now you're generating the substrate which can allow glycolysis to continue. So in this direction, this is what happens. Okay? The heart, though, normally is converting lactate to pyruvate, and then the pyruvate, through the enzyme PDH, goes into acetyl-CoA, into the TCA cycle, and the TCA cycle also generates reduced coenzymes. So, in order to use lactate the way the heart does, it requires similar things that it does for free fatty acid oxidation. And that is, so for lactate utilization, it requires oxygen. Now the opposite occurs in skeletal muscle during exercise. In the absence of sufficient oxygen, lactate is produced. But in the heart, lactate is being metabolized. It's being used as an energy source, and that requires oxygen. Okay? The other thing is, it requires mitochondria. It requires mitochondria for the metabolic machinery, the PDH, the TCA cycle, the electron transport system. These are all in the mitochondria, and these are essential for lactate oxidation, lactate utilization. In addition to that, the heart is sort of uniquely designed to use lactate as a substrate. It needs the lactate symport, which it has. And it has a specialized adaptation, and that is the enzyme LDH, lactate dehydrogenase, which you're probably most familiar as an enzyme to convert pyruvate to lactate. The form that exists in the heart is different. It's a different isoform than exists in skeletal muscle. And it preferentially converts lactate to pyruvate, has a higher affinity for lactate. So this is a special isoform. It's a cardiac-specific isoform. And the other factor that's required is the substrate concentration. So we need a lactate concentration in the blood. And just like every other enzymatic reaction or metabolic reaction, substrate availability is going to be driving the reaction, so law of mass action. So lactate concentrations can vary, and as they increase, lactate can become a very substantial substrate. Okay? So, we said free fatty acids can account for 70% of the ATP needs. Lactate could account for 20%. Under certain conditions when it's made available. In other words, it can be the second major substrate. But it requires this. It requires lactate to be out here, requires the symport, requires the specialized LDH, the cardiac-specific form, and then in the process we get reduced coenzyme, which has to be dealt with in the electron transport system, so we need mitochondria, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Now, when the heart is not well, when the heart has atherosclerosis or compromised coronary blood flow and oxygen is at a premium, then this pathway is just the opposite. Glucose goes to pyruvate, and glucose cannot go into acetyl-CoA, cannot be converted to acetyl-CoA through PDH. Pyruvate gets converted to lactate. So when the heart starts producing lactate, that's a bad sign. Usually the heart is a net lactate importer rather than exporter. And other substrates include ketone bodies, which can be produced in various forms of diabetes. Okay, any questions on metabolism? No? Okay, let's move on now and talk about the vasculature. So we've been talking about the cardiac muscle for a few weeks now. We're going to talk about the vascular system for a few weeks, and then we're going to integrate the cardiac and the vascular systems into a cardiovascular system. So this is the kind of structure we're looking at, figure 21.4. I've shown you this before. We're going to talk about some generalized concepts in terms of the overview. Then we're going to talk about some very simple hemodynamic principles that you all remember from physics that you took and enjoyed so much. And then we're going to talk about the arterial system today and special features of the arterial system that are physiologically relevant. And then the arterioles, capillaries, lymphatics, and the venous side of the circulation, and I'm missing a letter there, but that's okay. So in terms of overview, let's just talk about the generalized layout of the cardiovascular system. And this is figure 21.1 from your textbook. And it shows a couple of features, which I'll try to highlight. In these columns are the various blood vessels going from the aorta all the way up to the superior and inferior vena cava. The pulmonary we won't talk about, and the heart we'll talk about later on. So let's just focus on the systemic circulation. And as you know, in terms of number, there's only one aorta. There's two vena cava, superior and inferior. But if you start looking at the numbers, the branching out, which you can see here, we have one aorta coming off here. Here's the aorta right here, and tremendous branching, of course, as you're familiar with. And the branching here, we can get a million arteries coming off and a billion capillaries, or a billion arterioles and somewhat similar number of capillaries. This branching is very important. We'll come back to the hemodynamic consequences of that. In terms of the cross-sectional area, well, the aorta is about 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters squared. So that's this. And this, just to remind you, or just to highlight the fact, this is not from a human, it's from a 20-kilogram dog. So numbers are slightly bigger in a human. But it just gives you a sense. Now this, the stuff that's shown in this table is shown better in the next figure. And this figure I'll show you once again later on. So a few things here. This is the pressure, and we're going from aorta to vena cava. So we're going into the from the aorta to the arterioles to the capillaries, venules, superior vena cava, left ventricle. Superior vena cava right here. These are the larger arteries, and then the smaller smaller venules, and then larger veins right here. So the L stands for large and the S stands for small. Okay, so the points to be made here, if we look at cross-sectional area, the cross-sectional area increases dramatically at the level of the capillaries. And the reason for this is because of the sheer number of the capillaries. The capillaries themselves have the smallest cross-sectional area of any component of the vasculature system. But because there's so many, and because of their arrangement, these give rise to very important properties, one of which is the cross-sectional area. The pressure is the other point I'd like to make. We have a very pulsatile pressure coming out of the aorta in the large arteries, and as we get into the smaller arteries and arterioles, we can see that the pressure drops, that's the first thing, and the pulsatility drops. We're losing our pulse pressure. And then eventually we get into the capillaries and the pressure has gone from about 100 millimeters of mercury down to about 35 millimeters of mercury. And at the other end of the capillaries, about 15, as we enter into the venules and then to the small veins and the large veins, it's getting close to zero. And we're going to talk about the consequences of these pressure gradients in the vasculature in the subsequent lectures. Now you can see here the velocity effect, and I'll talk about that later today. The linear velocity decreases as we approach the capillaries. This is very important to facilitate exchange. Okay? So that's the overall layout. Now let's look at the generalized structure. Now we can look at the vasculature as a simple tube, and that has some merit in describing the features of the vasculature. And we look at the tube, or a collection of tubes, as having perhaps three components. So if this is the tube right here, the tube of course has a lumen through which the blood moves, and it has a wall which confines the lumen, is subject to regulation by hormones, controls how blood flow is distributed, etc., etc. It also is an endocrine organ, paracrine organ, has many functions. So the innermost layer, the layer that's right on the lumen, is called the tunica intima. Tunica intima is made up of one cell thick, and this cell is the endothelium. endothelial cells make up this. And despite the fact that it's one cell thick, this is a very important layer that lines the entire vasculature. These cells secrete certain chemicals which have profound effects on how blood flow is regulated. We'll talk about it. The endothelium of the three structures I'm going to talk about is the only one that's present throughout the entire vasculature. When we get to the capillaries, for example, the smallest component in the vascular tree, they are made up of only an endothelium. They do not have the other layers because they're there to facilitate the exchange of substances from the lumen to outside and vice versa. So we'll talk about the endothelial or the tunica intima in more detail. The next layer is the tunica media. Now this layer doesn't exist in the capillaries, but it exists in all other components, in the arterioles, the venules, the arteries, and the veins. And the tunica media has some very important features in it. One of them is the presence of vascular smooth muscle cells. Or VSM. Vascular smooth muscle cells allow the radius of the blood vessel to change and to respond to its environment, whether it's hormones, neurotransmitters, levels of oxygen, what have you. The vascular smooth muscle cell is also affected by certain disease processes like atherosclerosis. We'll talk about that. Now the tunica media also contains other components, elastin. This is a extracellular, well, this is a protein that sits in there and it gives it elastic-like properties, which are very important. And the outermost layer is the tunica adventitia. Now this contains connective tissue. It also is the point where nerves come in for innervation. And in some cases, some blood vessels have their own blood supply. Some blood vessels are so large that they need blood to supply the metabolic activity of the cells that make up the blood vessel. And so those blood vessels would come in with the tunica adventitia. Okay, so those are the three layers and they're shown here. Okay, let's go now on to talk about hemodynamics. And hemodynamics are extremely important. And of these, perhaps the most important principle is Ohm's law, which we've seen already. We saw when we talked about electrophysiology. Well, Ohm's law is also important when we talk about the hemodynamics. So Ohm's law, as we described it before, is V equals IR. And of course, V was actually difference in voltage between two locations. And the voltage was the driving force for current. Now, the hemodynamic equivalent of voltage is pressure. So if we think of a garden hose and you turn on the tap, water moves through the garden hose because there's a pressure head at the faucet that's greater than the pressure at the other end. So we have a difference in pressure at the two ends. This is a driving force. So the equivalent of voltage is pressure. Now current is the movement of ions, and in this case we're talking about the movement of a fluid, and we describe it as flow rather than current. And the letter to describe flow is Q. So the hemodynamic equivalent of Ohm's law is pressure equals flow times resistance. It's easy to remember because it's an alphabetical sequence. Okay? We'll talk about pressure and we'll talk about flow, but right now I want to focus on resistance. We're going to see that resistance is probably the most important variable in this equation, and we'll see why. Now there's several factors that influence resistance. But the first, we take a single segment, a tube segment. It could be anything. It could be an artery. We can describe the resistance of this tube based on Poussé's law. Poussé's law. States that the resistance here is proportional to the viscosity of the blood and the length of the tube, and inversely proportional to the radius. So the equation is 8 times eta, which is viscosity of the blood, times the length of the tube, over pi r to the fourth power. Now, physiologically, let me just put the resistance in a better place here. The resistance, you can see here, is determined by radius. Viscosity typically isn't changing from day to day unless you have a major blood loss or you're blood doping or you're doing something like that, but generally our viscosity is pretty uniform. If we increase our hematocrit, we increase the viscosity. If we decrease the hematocrit, we decrease the viscosity. So viscosity can change over a period of time in response to a stimulus, like going to altitude, or something with erythropoietin is secreted, some stimulus for it, it will change viscosity. But on a day-to-day basis, viscosity is relatively constant. And the length of the tube is relatively constant, unless you're taking Viagra, and then the length may change a bit. But the length of the tubing is relatively constant. We're not adding new blood vessels once we've established sort of adult kind of dimensions. Pi, of course, is a constant, and r radius to the fourth power is the most important variable right here. So we can say the bottom line here is that 1 over radius is proportional, or let me put it this way, radius is the driving force for resistance. By this equation. So radius to the minus fourth power is the determinant. So as the radius doubles, resistance falls by a factor of 16. So the impact is huge. So small changes in the radius have a huge impact on resistance, and resistance, of course, can affect flow for a given pressure. Okay? Any questions on that? So that's the first. Now we're just considering one particular segment of the tube. So that's Poussé's law right there. And he's been honored. There are units called Poise units to describe this. So abbreviation of this guy's name. The next thing to consider in terms of resistance is the arrangement of the blood vessels. And as you know from physics, just like when we do DC circuit analysis, we can look at how the tubes are arranged and from that determine what the resistance will be. So let's look at three tubes that are put together. We have a tube that's right here and it's joined to a tube of smaller diameter, which in turn is joined to a tube of yet smaller diameter. So each one of these segments has a resistance you can define by Poussé's law. It's determined by the length of the tube and the radius of that tube. And so we can describe the resistance of each of these. We'd have R1 for this segment, R2, and R3. So again, just like you did in DC circuit analysis, the total resistance to go from point A to point B is the sum of those resistances. So, in terms of the tube here, which factor is contributing to the resistance and therefore contributing to the overall flow? Which is the dominant factor? Radius, but which segment? R1 is one guess. R3 has its incredibly higher resistance than R1 because its radius is so much smaller, and this is to the fourth power. So this resistance right here will dominate this equation. And the net resistance will be determined largely by R3 in the example that I gave, where we have a much greater radius in the first segment compared to the second compared to the third. So the smallest resistive element, when they're in series, will dictate, to a large degree, the overall resistance of the pathway. That's a very important concept. How dominating it is really depends on what its diameter or radius is compared to the other elements. But when it's much smaller, it will control that pathway. When we can control R3, we will control the resistance of the entire pathway. And we'll see later on what R3 is equivalent to. Now, as you know, as you saw in the diagrams before, the blood vessels are not arranged just in series, but they're also arranged in parallel. So we can take the same segments, this segment right here, this is R1, R2, and R3. So this is obviously a parallel arrangement of these resistive elements. Now we're interested in knowing the resistance across this parallel network. And this, again, from DC circuit analysis, is equal to, 1 over RT equals 1 over R1, 1 over R2 plus 1 over R3. Okay, now in terms of flow, which resistive element is going to be the major determinant of how things flow? 1, exactly. So as R1 gets smaller, as the resistance gets smaller, the resistance of the entire pathway gets smaller, and the flow will be predominantly through R1 when they're arranged in parallel. Now in series, everything's got to go through each resistive element. And so this last resistor, the smallest one, is dictating the entire movement. But in a parallel arrangement, it's just the opposite. Now, when you make R3 even smaller in terms of its radius, even bigger in terms of its resistance, it simply means that more flow will go through the elements that have less resistance or a larger radius. Okay? So this is completely different from what we saw in the other arrangement. So you need to understand that, because when we talk about flow, both of these factors will be determinants. When they're in series, it'll be the smallest radius is the largest resistive element, which will be the controlling factor. In parallel, it's just the opposite. So that equation is shown right here. Okay? Any questions on that? And that just shows you here, if we look at any one branch, we have a resistive element here in series, and then when we get into capillaries, we have one in parallel. But we can also look at each of these branches right here as being parallel to each other. So if this is, we could say, I don't have one that's really clean, but here's two that are clean up here. If this was R1 and R2, this is going to the head and neck, and this is going to, this is going to the, below the head and neck, somewhere. If the resistance here increases, it means the blood gets directed to other pathways of lower resistance because of the parallel arrangement of these pathways. But within a given pathway, the flow here will be determined by the resistance of the most resistive element. Okay? So that's an important concept. Okay, the next factor is linear velocity, and we talked about this already. Linear velocity is important because it determines the time that the blood spends in a blood vessel. And that will determine the ability to exchange nutrients, to absorb things from the extracellular space or to supply things to the tissue. And the velocity, linear velocity, equals the flow over the area. Now this is something, when you think about it, is obvious. If you do any whitewater canoeing or kayaking, you already know this. If you have a river that's moving at 5 miles an hour, that would be the flow. And then you constrict it. the water moving over that particular point, the linear velocity increases, but the net flow has not changed at all. The number of cubic feet per minute has stayed the same, but it's through a restricted area, so the linear velocity in that particular region increases, and that's why people like to kayak in those regions. Okay? So this is true also of the vasculature. It's shown right here in figure 25.1. We have a flow of 10 mLs per minute coming in here, and actually the 10 mLs per minute is constant throughout the entire pathway. But here the area is increased fivefold, from 2 centimeters squared to 10 centimeters squared, and the linear velocity decreases fivefold, from 5 centimeters per second to 1, and then back up. Okay? So this is important because when we get to the capillaries, which have a very large cross-sectional surface area, velocity decreases. And that's shown in the next slide. This is the slide I showed you previously, but these are the capillaries, and this is the velocity right here in the dotted line. The linear velocity is decreasing because surface area is increasing very dramatically because of the number of capillaries and the way they're arranged. Okay, any questions on this? So that's so much for the hemodynamic principles. We're now going to talk about each part of the vascular system one at a time, and we're going to start with the vessels as they come out of the heart. So the first vessel is the aorta. The large arteries form the arterial system, and their major function is to serve as a conduit. They're moving large amounts of blood to various capillary beds. Because they have large diameters, large radii, they have relatively low resistances. And so this is not a point of regulation, this is a point of distribution. The arterial system is meant to distribute blood, large diameters, they serve as a conduit, blood moves through there quickly. That's one of their important properties. The second feature of the arterial system that's very important is a factor, physical property, known as compliance. And compliance equals DVDP. And you can look at this in several ways, but if something's very compliant, as you increase the volume, the pressure doesn't change much. Compliance is an important property of the arteries, and we'll talk about why. So this is figure 26.1 from your textbook, and it looks at two scenarios. One is the blood is ejected into an arterial system that's very compliant, shown in the top panel, and one that's ejected into a rigid arterial system, shown down here. So we have reasonable compliance here, we have low compliance here. What happens in the highly compliant system is that when the blood is ejected into it, it distends the arterial system. Some of the energy is absorbed in stretching the arterial wall. This has a role of reducing the change in pressure that occurs with each systole. And then during diastole, which is shown in the other panel, some of this energy is released and propels the blood in the diastolic phase. Now, let's look at this in the extreme example that's shown in the next figure. This is figure 26.2 from your textbook. And the three examples are this. In the first example, we have a tube, and we have a continuous flow pump that's in series with the entire circuit. It's like a propeller. This pump is propelling blood through the circuit at a constant velocity and a constant pressure. There's no pulsatility. It's a continuous pump, and blood is always moving, so there's no variation in pressure or flow. And that's shown here in these little insets here. This is pressure constant in 100 millimeters of mercury, and flow is constant at 100 mL per second. All right. Now let's make something a little different now and make it more similar to the heart. We have a piston that's driving fluid here, and the piston moves up and down. So it is pulsatile, and this is closer to what the heart does. And when we eject blood into the circulation, it's when the piston moves down, then we get a flow. But the flow here, this is with a rigid tube. This is like a copper tube that you have in your plumbing or PVC. It doesn't matter. When we have a rigid tube, The pressure varies from 200 millimeters of mercury when we have the downstroke to 0 millimeters of mercury when we have the upstroke, or systole and diastole, however you want to call it. And the same is true with the flow. The flow is very high on the downstroke, and then there's no flow. And if you're not careful, you might even get suction going backwards, but we're assuming that it's not happening here. So in this case, we have a rigid tube, there's no compliance, there's no give in the system, and we have an infinite pulse pressure, if you will, if you want to equate this to the heart. It goes from 200 to zero. Now this is not a good idea. It's not a good idea for design of a cardiovascular system because it means there's periods of time when the pressure head is zero and that affects blood flow to major organs like the brain. You don't want that. You want flow to the brain and other organs that you consider, whatever your favorite organs are, considered to be important. You want flow to be kept to some minimal level that's important. This pulsatility is not a good thing. And remember that in the heart, this resting period is actually 2 times or 3 times longer than the systolic phase. So it means you have long periods in which the pressure is zero. It's not good. All right, let's add a dimension to this model, and now we make this tube highly compliant. When we make the tube highly compliant, when the downstroke, we have a distension of this tube, and what the distension does is, just as we showed in the previous slide, it absorbs some of the energy on the downstroke and supplies energy on the upstroke so that pressure is held constant over the duration of the cycle. Now, in order to be completely linear here, it means we have to have very, very high compliance, like infinite compliance. Now, this bottom panel is wrong. The flow is also constant. The flow will be like up here at about 100 millimeters per second. Okay? So if we add infinite compliance to this system, we get constant flow, constant pressure. So in real life, we're somewhere in between these. Now, just as an aside, when people are designing artificial hearts, and I think you're familiar with some of them, or left ventricular assist devices, there are two types of models. There's a pump that's continuous like this, and there's a pump that's pulsatile. And people are designing and patenting devices that use both of these different designs to propel blood into the circulation. Maybe later on I can talk about these in the pathophysiology section. So these, somewhere between these two examples is what we have in real life. But an important facet of this compliance is that, well, this just shows you the effect of compliance on pulse pressure. And what's happening in these, we have three panels in the horizontal direction and three panels vertically. The panels in the horizontal are reflecting a decreased compliance from 43 to 14 to 3.6. The panels here on the vertical side represent changes in pressure. I'm going to ignore those right now. Total peripheral resistance. Let's just take an example at a given resistance, and you can see the effect of compliance. This is the arterial pressure trace right here. This is diastole. This is the peak of systole. This is the dichrotic notch. Maybe this one's a better one to see. This is close. These values are closer to being normal values. So diastolic pressure is maybe 80 millimeters of mercury. It rises dichrotic notch. As compliance decreases, you can see the effect here is to increase the pulsatility of the system. In other words, the pulse pressure is increasing. So going back to the previous slide, as we decrease the compliance here, we're moving to a system that's closer to this, in which pulsatility is infinite, from a system in which pulsatility was dampened by reasonable compliance. Well, what changes the compliance? Well, unfortunately for me, the compliance changes with age. The compliance decreases with age. As the vessels become more stiff, as they build up connective tissue, as they lose elastin, as they lose some components and they become larger and calcified, etc., this is equivalent to aging. And this is shown in the next, this is figure 26.4. So shown here are different age groups from 20s, 20-somethings, you guys, all the way up to the 71 to 78. This is my category right here. And you can look at the change in volume versus pressure. So the slope of this line is compliance. That's what compliance is, dV, dP. So we can see the slope is decreasing as you get older, compliance decreases. Is pulsatility bad? Yeah, it is. It's bad for a couple of reasons. You're increasing the pulse pressure. It means that the arterial system is seeing more pressure with each beat, which can damage the arterial tree even further. So it's not good on hemodynamics. If you can reduce the pulse pressure, then we have less fluctuation in the pressure between beats or from beat to beat, less damage to the circulatory system. Okay, any questions on that? No? Okay. So this decrease in compliance, we could call this arterial sclerosis. And arterial sclerosis means literally hardening of the arteries. And it's not exactly the same as atherosclerosis, which we'll talk about later on. All right, let's move on now, and we're going to move downstream. The arteries are large conduits that have reasonably high compliance. Those are important physiological features of the arteries. Now let's move to the arterioles. And the arterioles are extremely important to regulate flow. The arterioles have a much smaller much smaller radius than the arteries. So as a consequence, they are the major resistive element in the vascular tree. If these are the arteries right here, now we have the arterioles at this point right here. So they're a major resistive element, and because of that, they're a major determinant of blood flow. So blood flow is going to be determined by the driving force and the resistance. So we can say Q equals P over resistance. We can modify this equation now, and we can say Q is proportional to force times radius to the fourth power. So I'm substituting in resistance here with radius based on Poussé's law. Pressure is the driving force, and this is the ability for the flow to continue based on the resistive elements. Okay? So we have here now, as radius increases, we have increased flow, and conversely, as radius decreases, we have decreased flow. So they determine flow by varying their radius. And controlling radius is an important feature of the arterioles to determine where flow goes, how much goes, and other features like that. So let's describe the structure, first of all, of the arterioles. So this is figure 26.1. From your textbook, 28.1. So it's kind of out of sequence here. But it's in the section on coronary blood vessels. But this is a arteriole that's part of the coronary vasculature, but it could be just about anywhere else. Now just to show you here, the diameter of this bar is 5 microns, and so 5 microns would be right here. Now capillaries are designed to be as large as the blood cell that goes through them. And red blood cells are typically about 7 microns in diameter. So capillaries are much smaller than the arterioles. But we'll see that it's the arterioles that are determining the resistance in the pathway. And the reason for that is the capillaries are in a parallel arrangement and the arterioles are not. So this goes back to the hemodynamic principles we talked about. As we look at this arteriole, we have a tunica intima, an endothelium right here, and that's noted by an E. This is the nucleus of the endothelial cell. And you can see this lining right here. It's a very important feature. Surrounding that, we have vascular smooth muscle cells. So the vascular smooth muscle cells form concentric rings around the lumen, as does other elements like elastin. And on the outside, we have the tunica adventitia. Now, in more detail here, you can see vascular smooth muscle cells and the nucleus of the vascular smooth muscle cells. I'll be talking about these later on. Okay? So, this radius from here to here will determine resistance. So, radius to the fourth power will determine the resistance. The radius is controlled by these vascular smooth muscle cells. As they contract, and because they're in concentric rings, they close down the lumen. they make the resistance incredibly higher and they decrease the flow. So let's talk about vascular smooth muscle cells. Since these are the major determinants of the lumen of the blood vessel, the radius of the blood vessel and the arterioles, how do they function? Well, first we're going to talk about the structure of the vascular smooth muscle cells. And this is a diagram 19.2 from your textbook, and it shows different kinds of smooth muscle cells, but the one in panel A is from an arteriole. And this arteriole, you can see the vascular smooth muscle cells. So this is a scanning electron micrograph, and you can see the concentric rings. You're only looking at the top surface, but you can see these smooth muscle cells are forming ring-like structures, and they continue around the other side of the blood vessel. They're able to squeeze down on this blood vessel to control its radius. We have other organs here that I'm not going to talk about. This is intestines, and what's this? This is from the testicular duct. So we're focusing on arterioles right here. Okay. Just to show you some micrographs, this is figure 19.3. These are vascular smooth muscle cells right here. There's two of them. And many vascular smooth muscle cells are connected to each other, much like cardiac myocytes are, through a gap junction. And the gap junction is shown right here. Now, I should preface my discussion of vascular smooth muscle cells to tell you that there's a tremendous variety in the function and the structure of vascular smooth muscle cells. For example, the vascular smooth muscle cells in arteries and arterioles is different. And the smooth muscle cells in the lungs and the bladder, in the ureters, etc., are different. So I'm going to talk, first of all, in a generalized sense, but gap junctions do not appear between every type of smooth muscle. They appear when you want some sort of electrical continuity between adjacent vascular smooth muscle cells like you do in the heart. But in some smooth muscle cells, they are not electrically coupled. All right. I'll talk about that later. The vascular smooth muscle cells do contain a sarcoplasmic reticulum that's shown here. And they contain the contractile machinery that allows them to contract change the radius and therefore the resistance of the blood vessel. This just shows you in higher magnification what vascular smooth muscle cells look like. This is from a pulmonary artery. But when we look at it, we see thick and thin filaments. So the structure of smooth muscle cells is that they contain thick and thin filaments, and the thick and thin filaments have some features in common. So these filaments I'm running out of time but the thick filaments contain myosin. It's just that the type of myosin is different. Myosin has very different properties, but its basic function is the same. It forms cross bridges in conjunction with its partner on the thin filament actin. So smooth muscle cells have thick and thin filaments, and they form cross bridges, which are the basis of controlling the contractile state, which controls the radius, which controls the resistance. However, we'll see this in next Friday, the thick and thin filaments are not arranged in sarcomeres with the striking periodicity, with the striking striations that we see in cardiac and skeletal muscle. You do not see the kind of striations, and therefore this is non-striated muscle or smooth muscle. That's why smooth muscle is called smooth muscle, is because when you look at it in a light microscope, you do not see those striated appearance that you see in the other two types of muscle we've talked about. Okay, I'll continue this on Friday.